Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Hosting today's program is co-producer and our marketing strategist, Doug Sohn. Doug, why don't you get us started?
William Seidman is a recognized expert on the subject of executive decision-making and performance improvement, and co-founder, CEO, and president of Cerebyte, a consultancy focused on increasing organizational performance. He is co-author of The Star Factor, Discover What Your Top Performers Do Differently and Inspire a New Level of Greatness in All, published by AMACOM, a division of American Management Association. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay, so what is the star factor?
We often hear people say things like, if only I could clone Joe or Susan, or I wish I had more people like my top performers.
Right.
In very simple terms, there are some people in organizations who just consistently and systematically outperform others. They're really extraordinary. And what the star factor is about is discovering what makes these people so different, so much better than everybody else, and then raising everybody else to the same performance level as the stars. Now, you can imagine the potential impact of having everybody be like the stars. Just think about the attitude difference and the kind of culture and the morale and the financial performance if you just had this environment filled with your best people. You know, what a great place that would be to work. So we're all about figuring out what makes the stars so great, finding the stars too, and getting everybody else to be just as great too.
Can you sort of tell us about some examples of organizations that have sort of achieved results using this process?
Yeah, this process has been used in just widely diverse environments. Everything from leading high-tech company to a fast food company. It has been used in aerospace on the launch of microspacecraft to the outer planets, to selling insurance, to federal inspectors. Really, really diverse. In the places that we could get great actual outcome measures, in general, we're averaging about a 20x return on investment. That's not 20%, that's 20 times. So for each dollar invested, people are getting $20 back. In a very, very carefully measured environment where we had, it was retail sales for auto parts, we had control groups, we had pre and post tests. The actual return on investment in this very carefully managed and experimental environment was 39x. So $39
wow.
For every dollar you got back. Pretty good, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Now, in other environments, you don't get quite such clean measures. So, for instance, we work with a fast food chain, and they had, before the use of this methodology, about 300% turnover in each restaurant.
Right.
They got that down to less than 100%. So, really big improvement and change to their hiring costs, their stability, and so on. In a manufacturing environment, they had a huge impact on demand forecasting. And each percentage improvement in their ability to forecast what the factory should produce was worth $50 million. A lot of money there.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
And the people using this methodology, focusing on the stars and getting everybody else to be like the stars, were twice as accurate in their demand forecasting as others. And there's a whole list of these kind of improvements for insurance environments, for hospitals, health cares. There was a 25% cut in emergency room visits, just really substantive stuff. And all those outcome measures are really important. But there's a subtle change that occurs as well, in that it creates cultures where people want to be there. We call them cultures of greatness. And you think about the kind of great attitudes and energy and passion that the true stars bring to an organization, and then picture where everybody's feeling that. The excitement and buzz is just extraordinary. And if you said to me, you know, like, what's the biggest result you get this sense of being just great places to work with just extraordinary productivity.
So I guess there are stars in different areas of the organization that have to be identified. Are they in many cases invisible, or how do you identify them within your organization? Do you have some tips on that?
Yeah, great question. A lot of people get very concerned about how do you find the stars. And the stars are really distinctive in two particular ways. First of all, they simply bring greater energy and passion to their work. And the reason they do that, turns out, is they think differently about their job. They really have a different mental model about why they're doing it. And because of this passion, they are consistently better organized and more efficient in the action they take. Of these two, the passion is the most important because it drives everything else. The stars are always driven by a commitment to achieving a compelling purpose, some sort of greater social good. For example, we were working with a pharmacy chain where the star pharmacy managers thought of themselves, and this is in their words, as a critical part of the family emergency response system. So they were all about helping families in distress. Everyone else was about doing 120 prescriptions a day. So the stars were very transformational in their thinking and in how they interact with everybody, and all the lesser performers were very transactional, just trying to make the numbers, just trying to survive daily pressures. This sense of compelling purpose drives the stars to become operationally excellent. They have learned through their deep experience what really works and what to avoid. As an example, that fast food chain I mentioned earlier,
right.
The managers got a report about their food costs that was 3 inches thick. So picture this big, fat report. And every week they got that. The stars focused on just one line of the report as the primary and most efficient indicator of the health of their business. And it turned out it's the chicken line.
Right.
Chicken was simply harder to manage than other things. It was harder to maintain cooking. It got stolen more. If the chicken costs were in line, this was a leading indicator that everything else was in line too. So by focusing on the chicken line, they reduced a very complex management process to just a few focused minutes of attention. And they simply were better at managing the restaurant.
So then does that get shared within the organization, this learning that really all we have to focus on is the chicken and not the 3-inch thick report?
That's correct.
Okay.
So that becomes a pointer to everybody else for a vastly more efficient kind of behavior. And it turns out that that also then ties into the compelling purpose about the speed of management, the speed of the organization, which has both an emotional response, it turns out, and a financial impact on what they're doing. But you're exactly right. It focuses right in on a key element. This question started by focusing on how do you identify them.
Sure.
And the reason I wanted to talk about that is when you start to think about this sense of passion and the operational excellence, these are pretty distinctive characteristics. And it turns out that organizations can identify these folks very, very simply. You can go to the management team and you can say, who are the people you most respect? So, for instance, in that restaurant chain, we could say, who are the restaurant managers you most respect? Or if you're in an engineering environment, who are the engineers you most respect? And what happens is the management team can literally visualize who these people are. They have a mental picture of that. And you then test that mental picture by asking, are these your go-to people? If you get all jammed up, if you're having a crisis, do you go to these people as your primary resource? And then the second question is, if they tell you how to do something like focus on the chicken line, you believe them without spending a lot of time second-guessing them. And it turns out that anyone who basically is the answer to all three of those questions, you respect them, they're your go-to people, you trust what they say.
Right.
That's a star. Now, that turned out to be so simple and so fast that we actually didn't believe it was true. we looked at all the kind of standard human resource analytic tools, and we tried them for network analysis and knowledge sharing and things like that to basically produce a list of the stars, and it turned out it produced the identical list. And that analytic process took months and thousands of dollars, whereas the respect criteria takes typically 20 minutes to make sure you talk to everybody and is free.
Right.
And it produces the exact same list. So you're way ahead of the ball game that way.
And you've spent a lot less money.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, one thing you note in the book is that top performers can't articulate why they're so good at their jobs themselves, I guess. So how do you discover the skills, attitudes, and knowledge that drive a star?
Yeah, that's a great question. In the world of knowledge management, there was always a concern that you couldn't get information from the stars. And people would go to the stars and say, tell me what makes you great. And because they were actually unconscious of what made them so extraordinary, they couldn't answer the question.
Right. They're just saying, we just do it. That's kind of the way they feel, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually quite a mystery to them why somebody would even ask the question.
Yeah.
Like, why are you asking me that? Of course it's obvious how you do it. So to really get to their deep knowledge, particularly this underlying mental model, this sense of purpose, the first thing you have to do is get them very engaged.
Okay.
And stars, it turns out, are actually pretty easy to get engaged, even though the conventional wisdom is that they're difficult to get engaged. We invite them by saying to them, we'd like to invite you to a 3-day workshop where you will meet with the few people who are your peers in the organization to discuss greatness in your function. And you can imagine what the response is. The very first thing they say is, who are my peers?
Right.
This is obviously a very flattering kind of thing. And what's interesting is that they immediately transition from that question to talking about their view of greatness. Here is what it means to be a great salesperson or a service person or a marketing person. Because part of being a star is they're just fascinated by that whole process.
Right.
So they're just kind of instantly engaged. So that produces initial engagement. But then you have to actually get them talking about the right things when you're interacting with them. So we hold this 3-day workshop that we call a wisdom discovery session.
Okay.
Where we say to the stars, we would like you to coach a facilitator who is pretty good at the job, but not great. And we'd like you to coach them and guide them in how to be great. And they love the idea of having a disciple.
Do you have like an example of how that would work?
Sure. So a later example I'm going to give is we're working with a program right now that is designed to develop middle managers and junior executives to truly become transformational leaders of emerging business units. So
okay.
Develop some pretty serious leadership skills.
Right.
So the facilitator comes in and says, I am a good middle manager. I'm good because I'm intelligent, competent, motivated, and I'm really committed to becoming great, but I just don't know how to be great. Stars, will you coach me on how to be great? And I'm going to ask you a series of questions that are designed to get you thinking about and talking about what greatness is. And as you talk, I'm going to record your answers in a computer, and it's going to be projected up so you can see what I heard. And if I haven't captured your notion of greatness, stop me right away. And tell me where I miss greatness, and we'll build it out so it's incredibly great. So what happens then is the stars become intrigued by trying to coach a disciple.
Sure.
And they also have different images of what it means to be great. So they'll start talking very intensely to each other. And so intensely that there have been a couple times, for instance, where we hit a break time, and we said to them, it's time for a break, and they didn't stop. We said to them again, it's time for a break, and they didn't stop. And we were kind of concerned because they'd gone quite a long time without going to the bathroom, without any food and things like that. So finally we actually turned off the lights in the room, and the only thing that was on was the emergency lighting in the room, and they still kept talking. They were just so gripped by this.
Right.
And in doing that, they say things like, well, in order to be great, you really need to know these three reports, or you really need to think of the client this way. Or as you're thinking, for instance, about packaging a solution for selling environment, you really need to know these different elements and how you connect with a client. So they really dig into the deep things that make them so extraordinary. And again, as they're saying these things, the facilitator is writing them up, and it's literally kind of magically appearing on a screen in front of them. And they will say things like, you didn't quite get that right. Here is what greatness is. Or somebody will say a more interesting thing. One star will say, well, this is what I do that's great. And another star will turn to them and say, no, you don't. Here's what you really do.
Right.
And it's in that great dialogue that emerges that you find out, first of all, what their compelling purpose is, what drives them to be extraordinary. And I already kind of mentioned a purpose, for instance, on that pharmacy chain about helping families in distress. Let me give you another example, for instance, for that fast food chain. You don't often think about fast food and speed of service as creating a social good. But the star restaurant managers in this chain thought of themselves as creating speed of service, not just because it created financial benefit, and the financial benefits were considerable. A 6-second improvement in speed of service at a drive-through created a 1% increase in sales.
Wow.
So pretty substantive, right?
Right.
But they never thought of it that way. They thought of it in two forms. They thought of it as helping a soccer mom who had tired, hungry kids in the car get a meal fast. So basically helping her with her family. And they thought of it as helping somebody who was an hourly worker have a little bit more quality time in their day because they had a few more minutes to eat their meal rather than standing in line. So it wasn't just making money, which they did, but it was really about helping people. And that then drives all these things.
And it sounds like they were putting themselves in the shoes of the customer and envisioning, you know, how the customer would feel interfacing with their business.
Exactly. A tremendous sense of empathy. But it was even subtler than that, in that, yes, it was empathy, but it was also in the context of the fact that they still had to produce a business result.
Right. Sure.
So one of the real skills that the stars have is balancing those different potentially conflicting forces.
Okay, now we've talked about the stars and putting them in a workshop and, you know, getting them all together, but how do you then take their attitudes and behaviors and get them to the rest of the organization? How do you integrate that within the larger culture?
That's a great question, because what often happens in organizations is it's been such a challenge to find out what makes the stars so extraordinary that they tended to stop their thought process at that point. And we had a number of instances, particularly where we were working with an aerospace company, where we literally got the expertise of rocket scientists. And this particular area was, how do you launch a microspacecraft to the outer planets? So it was really cool, sophisticated kinds of stuff.
Right.
And at the end of the program, we said to them, what are you going to do with this expertise? And everybody looked at each other and said, well, we hadn't thought about that. And it turns out that the program was canceled shortly after that because they couldn't show any value from knowledge.
Okay.
So your question is right on the money, because it's about how you show value from knowledge. And the way you show value from knowledge is first by creating an intense sense of motivation for people who want to be like the stars. So let me tell you a story of how that worked in a really tough environment.
Okay.
This was a call center in an advertising firm that was responsible basically for dealing with problems in published and print and digital ads.
Okay.
So when anybody called this call center, they were already angry.
Right.
Something was wrong with their ad. So being a phone person in this center was an incredibly negative intense experience. And they were held to very, very tight response time metrics. They were only typically allowed about 90 seconds on a call. They were expected to resolve things very quickly. It was an incredibly high-pressure place to work.
Sure.
And the turnover was more than 50%. When we talked to the stars, though, it turns out that the stars kind of ignored the metrics and ignored all these other pressures, and they focused on a different paradigm of what they were doing with the client. They saw themselves, and these are their words, this is a quote, as the last line of defense in saving the customer relationship. So you had customers calling in who were already to abandon this company, and they were calling in with the sort of last desperate hope that something would be salvaged out of the relationship.
Right.
So it was a whole different way of thinking about it. And because they thought of it that way, they really thought they were strategically critical to the company and to the customer, that they were the ones who were sustaining long-term customer loyalty, and that their ability to find a solution that empathized with the client, met the client's real needs where appropriate, and still were consistent with the company guidelines was an incredibly important role, an important role that they just loved. So we got them to articulate that. We then presented to people, to the other call center folks in a particular way, and they looked at it, and it kind of created a resonance. And this resonance is such that people would look at it, and they would say, wow, that's a great way to think about the role. I would really like to be a contributor to that purpose. I would like to be that kind of person.
Right.
And so you actually had a physiological change amongst people when they start to think of themselves that differently. They walk differently. They talk differently. They were very excited. I mean, it was just completely different. And it showed up in the metrics. First call resolutions doubled. So basically, they're doing a much better job of finding solutions fast, and it doubled without adding extra time.
Right.
And the number of escalations dropped from 84 a day to 14 a day. So really important stuff happened there. Now, there's a lot of science underneath it. Want me to dig into the science a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems very interesting. What the stars have really done is unlocked sort of the secret sauce as to what will motivate people to do a better job. And in many cases, it sounds like that's really empathizing with the customer and, you know, doing not focusing on the metrics that are traditional, but focusing on something different. And the call center example you gave to me sounds like what we've heard from the way Zappos operates, for instance. Like, it's not the length of the call, it's the resolution and making the customer, you know, feel like they've had their problem resolved.
Exactly. It's first and foremost understanding that different mental model. If your mental model is, I've got to do 90 seconds on a call,
right,
you're not going to be successful.
Yes.
If your mental model is, I need to be the strategic linkage between really helping the customer be successful and my company be successful, you're thinking about it in a completely different way. And that mental model becomes the driver of getting people motivated. Now, the process of gathering that mental model is really different from the processes you use to get people involved with it. So you notice I said you present that mental model, that purpose, to people in a particular way.
Right.
This uses two bodies of science. You use the science of what's called FAIR process and the neuroscience of positive images. What FAIR process says is if during the process of helping somebody develop themselves, you do it in a way that creates a sense of personal honor and dignity, they are far more likely to be open to new ideas than if you do things in a way that diminishes them. So things like heavy compliance, checklists, financial incentives, these tend to say to people that we basically don't trust you to do the right job. We're going to force you to do the right job.
Right.
Whereas if you come in and say, we think you're already amazing, and we think you would be more amazing if you aligned with this greater purpose, a la the Zappos example you gave. To a phenomenal degree, people respond to that. They want to be like that themselves. Now, what's interesting is people have kind of known that for a long time. in the last few years, the use of MRIs and other brain imaging has actually told us a lot about what's going on when people are in that state. So as people respond to that sense of an honor and dignity, there's actually release of neurochemicals, brain chemistry, that cause people to enter a state of well-being. And in that state of well-being, the science has shown that they're literally more open to new ideas and learn them faster. So fair process isn't just honor and dignity, but it's actually creating a neural effect that impacts people's ability to learn. If an individual then writes down their own version of that purpose, the act of writing itself suppresses portions of the brain that are associated with fear and resistance and stimulates portions of the brain that are associated with a sense of empowerment and control. So at the same time you're getting people all excited and they're learning faster, you're actually doing some things that make it easier for people to learn. And if you do all of that in a group setting with some sort of social peer group, there's a release of additional neurochemicals that cause people to be still more open and more responsive to different ideas. So you take the notion of the star's greater purpose and you present it in a way that creates this neural bath of energy and excitement. And lo and behold, you have people literally saying, I want to be this way. I want to become great. I want to be part of the purpose. And so you've laid the foundation of an extraordinary change to the individual, but also an extraordinary change to the organization as more and more individuals start to function that way.
Right. And it does sound like this is really at the core of the cultures of many organizations that we look to as having great cultures such as Southwest Airlines or, as I mentioned before, Zappos.
Exactly. And a lot of people ask us, how do you change the culture of an organization? How do you create an extraordinary high-performing organization like, you know, Southwest Airlines or Zappos? And our answer is one person at a time.
Right.
And that one person at a time is plugging into that greater purpose. When you look at underperforming individuals and underperforming organizations, to a phenomenal degree, we find that they don't have a clean purpose. They have lame mission statements. They have PowerPoint slides.
Right.
When we talk about purpose, we're talking about something that is so energizing that each individual says, yeah, that's the kind of company I want to be part of. That's the kind of person I want to be. And it's at a whole different level.
Yeah, and I think we can wrap up with that and just let everybody know that your latest book is called The Star Factor, and it's published by Amacom. And thanks again, Bill Seidman. This has been a great little chat.
Good. Glad you liked it. Thanks very much.
We have a special gift for our loyal Edgewise listeners, a free copy of an ebook entitled AMA Business Bootcamp. In it, we have assembled the most critical must-have skills for managers and leaders. To download your copy, simply visit our website, amanet.org/bootcamp. That's amanet.org/BOOTCAMP. This free download will now be available until December 31st, 2013, so get your copy now.
Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.